quorum, we'll just open up the meeting, not officially yet. We can't take any official action, but...
We've got one now.
We got a quorum, Ron?
Yep.
Okay, it looks like we do have a quorum. Go ahead with the, Mr. Gottlieb, the roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Constein? Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Hertas?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lohmer? Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger?
Here.
Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam? Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward?
Here.
Representative Winkler?
Here.
And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we've got a quorum. Will somebody move the minutes of March 3rd? Representative Hertas moves the minutes of March 3rd. Any problems? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the first bill up is Representative Erdahl with House File 484. Where did he go? Oh, there he is. Representative Erdahl, I can move your bill to be recommended to pass and move to the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
Just one moment, I got to get my papers straight now. Here we go. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Under federal law, certain nonprofit organizations are eligible to receive FEMA grants for disaster relief. FEMA provides disaster aid to nonprofits under its public assistance program, mostly to states and local government units. Eligible private nonprofits are those that provide critical services in the event of disaster. Our rural cooperatives were created in 1935. They provide critical services. They provide electricity to rural Minnesota. And nonprofit utility groups are eligible for the FEMA public disaster aid because they provide these critical services as defined in federal law. FEMA may currently provide up to 75% of the recipient's disaster cost. Co-ops, states, and local government units are responsible for the remaining 25%. The state of Minnesota pays part or all of the remaining 25% of eligible costs for local government units. The legislature appropriates money to the Department of Public Safety, who distribute it. Co-ops are eligible for the state FEMA match or the new state aid program for local government units that we passed a year ago. They're also eligible for DEED's business disaster relief, but this is not funded by the legislature for each disaster, and these grants are unpredictable. I want to make utility co-ops eligible for this disaster relief. Only utility co-ops are eligible in my amendment, in this bill, not social services or others who might be eligible for FEMA funding. Most of you can remember disasters that you may have had in your districts that left you without power and with your co-ops struggling with a monumental task. To me, this is about fairness. If you have a disaster in a municipally owned power plant in a town, it's eligible for the 75% FEMA and the 25% state match. If it is a disaster that occurs in greater Minnesota with an electric co-op, you get the 75% FEMA, and your ratepayers have to make up the 25%. And so this is a matter of making this a fair, even position. So with that, I do have a testifier.
Okay. Any questions so far? If not, yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these all not-for-profits, or are there any for-profit entities that would qualify under this statute?
I believe it's just not for nonprofits.
Representative Hertas, or do you have a question yet?
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are all of these entities also regulated under the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, or are there any of these that are not regulated under
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not I don't know for sure on that one. If they are all, when you say all, it's an absolute, I don't know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's one thing to provide money to folks who are a utility or that are not-for-profit or that are already regulated in another entity. It's a challenge to start to think about giving folks who might be for-profit or might not be regulated as a public utility the money. So if you could get that information for us, that would be helpful to have.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I think that my testifier will address that. You know, once again, these all qualify now. What I'm asking to do, they all qualify under the 75% FEMA. They just don't, at the present time, qualify for the 25% state match.
Sir, if you'd state your name and title before you begin.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. Tim Mergen, I'm the general manager of Meeker Cooperative Light and Power Association in Litchfield, Minnesota. If I may, I'll just go back to the questions that the representative asked.
Right.
All 45 cooperatives in the state of Minnesota are nonprofit. And the second part of your question was...
Mr. Chair, are they regulated by the PUC?
Oh, there you go. Sorry. Mr. Chair, we are all regulated by the PUC with the exception of rates. Only one of the 45 are rate regulated. But other than that, we are regulated by the PUC.
Okay, Representative, did you have a question?
Yeah.
And then Representative Neuberger. Oh, Representative Herthoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erdahl, I'm not familiar with what FEMA covers. Is it just the basic generating plant and damages to it, or does it also include all of the transmission lines as well?
Go ahead, sir.
I will defer to my testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative, FEMA covers basically anything, whether it's poles, wires, transformers, anything that we have as far as providing that distribution service. It might be a substation, all those type of things. There are a number of things pretty minor that they might not cover, but for the most part, when you're driving down the road, anything you see along the road that's power utility related, they will cover in a FEMA declared disaster.
Representative Hurtos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more question relating to this, then I'm presuming that it requires a disaster declaration for this to kick in. But do any of the nonprofits, what mechanism do they have to take care of these things when it's not a federal disaster or a declaration is declared? Is that funds that are set aside in reserve to anticipate these things in terms of the kind of the burden of the rate structure? Or do they have insurance in any way? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, no, there is no insurance available to cover anything like that. You just can't get it. That's not a possibility. As far as making those payments when those storms do happen, it goes right out of goes back into the ratepayers' pocketbook. They got to pay for it. I mean, that's what we've had to do. We were hit with three major storms. All three of them were declared federal disasters in 2011, 2012, and 2013. Out of that, we got 75% of it paid by FEMA through the, you know, federal disaster. It was that last 25% that was not covered. So that, along with the parts of the storms that were not covered under FEMA, all that goes back into our rate base, and our members in the end have to pay for it.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So, do local co-ops carry general disaster insurance, or is it more based on some type of inherent neglect that may happen or an accident? And not covered by natural disasters.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative, again, there is no disaster insurance available. You just can't buy it. You can't get it. It's just something that's not available. So it's just when your line goes down, you got to put it back up, and it comes out of the ratepayers' pockets.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two brief questions. This is for the testifier. Would you consider what you do in the co-ops, the function of the co-op, would you classify that as an essential service for the public?
Mr. Chair and Representative, absolutely. In this day and age, trying to live without electricity is just really an impossibility. And I'll give you just a real quick example. This is going back many years ago. I had an older gentleman who came up to me after we had an outage, and he asked me point blank. He said, "Do you know what happens when you lose power?" And of course, I sort of in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, "Well, yeah, I know what happens." But I said no, and he says, "All hell breaks loose." Mm-hmm. And really, in this day and age, that's exactly what happens.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one final question. In your best estimation, how many people are served, get their essential electrical services in the state of Minnesota? Just give me a round number from co-ops.
Mr. Berger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to throw out a number. Probably 1.5 million, I'm guessing. I just don't have a good handle on that statewide. I can tell you, Meeker Cooperative, we serve about 7,500 in our service territory. Now, we serve in Meeker County, Stearns, Renville, Wright County, McLeod, and Kandy, Ohio. Excuse me, those are the six counties, with the majority of that being maybe about 75% of those customers or members are in Meeker County.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some clarification here. So are all of the utilities electricity? If you get the 25% that's not covered by FEMA, then will you be able to decrease the rates? And is this retroactive at all to the disasters that have already happened, or is it just disasters going forward?
I'll answer the last one. It's Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. It is not retroactive. And do you want to answer the two, or should I?
Go ahead.
Give me the first one again, please.
Are all of the utilities that we're talking about electricity, or are there other utilities?
I believe they are all electricity, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, and in the event that the 25% that's not covered by FEMA will be covered in the future, will that allow folks to have their rates decreased, as you know that your infrastructure will be protected in a disaster?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that certainly would be up to each of the individual co-ops to decide, but I would imagine for the most part it would not be a reduction. It would be not an increase.
Okay, members, any questions? Members from the public, anybody wish to testify? If not, Representative Erdahl, you want some closing comments before we renew your motion?
Well, again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And now, all we're trying to do here is to help our residents of rural Minnesota, at least in this area, have an equal footing with those who have the benefit of living in cities and having the state of Minnesota pay for their share of the disaster, whereas currently in greater Minnesota, it's the ratepayers who have to make up that 25%.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Representative Erdahl. With that, I'll renew my motion to move Representative Erdahl's bill, House File 484, be recommended to pass and move to the referred to the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Now we have House File 801, Representative Johnson, new arson offense established.
Okay.
Okay, Representative Johnson, you can move your bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 801.
To go?
Where would you prefer?
General Register. As far as I know, nobody's asked for it.
Move to the General Register.
Found another place to put it. So move your bill to the recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
I'd make that motion.
Okay, Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Members, Mr. Chair, members, this bill deals with arson of real property, your home, your garage, your car, even your lawnmower. Yes, as a deputy, I've responded to the fires at lawnmowers, and we have found out that they have been intentionally set because of the insurance. The homeowners wanted a new lawnmower. It's surprising what some people will do. But the reason I bring this forward is it was through a friend of mine from the Isani County Attorney's Office, who's also a fireman. When he brought this to me, I didn't realize that the situation existed. We have a situation where with the wildfire arson, if a firefighter or emergency personnel gets injured, it is a crime. If we can prove who the person was that set that fire, it enhances the penalties if one of those emergency personnel gets injured. What we didn't realize is if somebody sets their home, or somebody sets a home, a business, a garage, a vehicle on fire, and emergency personnel gets injured, there's nothing we can do about it criminally unless they get killed. Then there's charges you can have if they're killed, but not if they're injured. And on the way down here today, I was thinking about one of the fires I responded to, not as a firefighter, but as a deputy sheriff. Our garage was burning. And I thought it looked funny because the toolbox was out of the garage, the car was out of the garage, the lawnmower was out of the garage. And when I talked to the homeowner, he had no idea how the fire started. This is back in the late 90s when a lot of people had cordless telephones. And I had a scanner in my squad car that did scan those frequencies because the Supreme Court had ruled that they were public and we could do that. I went to change the film in my camera because I was taking pictures of the fire, which is what we generally do. And all of a sudden I heard the homeowner talking to a friend of his, trying to get the information for his insurance company to report the fire, and talking about how he torched his garage so he could have a new garage built and have the insurance company pay for it. When I was hearing this stuff, I grabbed my tape recorder and I recorded it in case we needed it for court. And I then went back and talked to the homeowner again, and he did admit starting the garage fire. But because I caught him before he had turned it into the insurance company, there was really not much we could do. Fortunately, no firefighters were injured. But if a firefighter was injured, whether responding to the scene or at the fire, the person that started that fire had no responsibilities or no repercussions if somebody would have been injured, which I feel is wrong. And that's what this bill does. It enhances the penalties, so if an emergency personnel is injured while fighting a fire that was started by arson, if that person is caught and convicted, there is repercussions for that with increased penalties. Most of our firefighters are volunteers. In fact, about 80% of our firefighters in Minnesota are volunteers. And that means they're taking time away from their jobs, their families, their kids, not only to train, because now there's a lot of training requirements for the volunteer firefighters, but it's a lot of responsibility for them, and they take a lot of time away from their families and friends. And if they get injured responding to these arson fires, I think there should be some culpability on the person that started these fires. Today I have a couple testifiers with me. One is Isani County Assistant Attorney Robert Bienick, who brought this bill forward to me last session. I'm thankful we got a hearing today. And also from the Denise DeMars from the Arson Investigators Association, who the last arson fire that I worked as a deputy sheriff was the fire marshal that also assisted me trying to solve that case. Unfortunately, we still have not solved the fire that destroyed the Isani County Historical Society and a lot of the records and a lot of the historical items from Isani County, or the baseball shed that destroyed all the baseball equipment for the youth in our community. If they want to come up here to testify.
You're welcome, sir, if you give your name and title and begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Bienick. I'm an assistant Isani County attorney in the practicing criminal law in the Cambridge area. Also, I live in the Hugo area, and I'm a captain on the Hugo Fire Department. So I've had kind of a particular interest in the in this arson legislation. A couple years ago, I had worked on the there's some changes we made to the wildfire arson statute. And I'm here today because there's some other issues that have been identified in the current statutory scheme we have for arsons that we need to kind of plug the gap with this legislation. When you look historically, you know, arson traditionally, you know, involved buildings or dwellings, and as kind of the law developed, you saw that there was also a realization that sometimes personal property could be set on fire, and there were certain risks that would occur and damages that would occur because of that. And then the law also recognized that explosions really made sense to kind of add that into kind of the traditional harms that could be associated with arson. And more recently, it's been kind of the recognizing that there's also bodily harm that could result, either in the terms of firefighters that are injured, first responders that are injured, and also even just residents or owners. So I think we've seen the law kind of advance in that regard. In Minnesota, what we have in place right now is there are two instances where there's some punishment for bodily harm in the case of a wildfire arson, and this was as a result of the legislation a couple years ago, as well as negligent fires. There is currently a provision for penalties as a result of the negligent fires. What this bill does is this uses or takes a look at those other fires, kind of more the traditional arson fires, so your residence, your dwellings, other personal property that may fall into that. And what we do, what this bill does, is provides criminal penalties or specific criminal penalties based on different harms that are suffered. And it's basically using great bodily harm, substantial bodily harm, and demonstrable bodily harm standards that are already, I think, fairly well established in the law. And if someone suffers, or as a proximate cause of the fire, if someone suffers some of these injuries, they are subject to these different enhanced penalties. As part of the efforts here, actually the idea was first brought forward to me by Ms. Denise DeMars, who you'll hear from shortly. But we've got the support of the Minnesota chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators, the IAAI. We've got the support of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association on this bill, and we've got the support of the Minnesota State Fire Departments, the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the MCAA. Also, this bill has been reviewed by the State Fire Marshals Division, and they have no opposition to the bill. The DNR, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, has taken a look at the bill, and they also have no objection or no problem with what we're doing. And so, you know, based on that, I ask for the committee's support and ask that you vote in favor of this bill.
Okay, questions so far. Do you wish to testify, ma'am?
If I have to, I.
Well, it doesn't seem to be a real controversial bill, so you don't have to. Any questions so far? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious about adding felonies to the system. Seems like it makes a lot of sense, and I appreciate the bill. Just wondering if there is a fiscal note, and if so.
Representative Ward, I think the fiscal note came back zero. So not even a local impact, I guess. Anybody else? Representative Johnson?
Yes. Reference the fiscal note. I did come back at zero, not just the state, but local. What they found out during the fiscal note, there's 127 felony arson cases that have been filed in the last, from 2011 to 2013. And they estimate it'll be 47 new cases a year, but most of the 47 would be just changing from one felony to a different felony. So there's no real impact, and they also said possibility of one bed extra needed in the prisons every 2 or 3 years.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And due to the fact that I have no interest in this and have no background in fire at all, could you explain to those of us that aren't very knowledgeable the difference between arson and someone intentionally setting a fire, maybe has a permit, sets his garage on fire because it's dilapidated and he wants to burn it down and get rid of it, has his permit from the DNR and everything, sets that on, his neighbor calls in the fire, not knowing he was going to burn it down, someone gets injured responding to it. This isn't going to reach them because it doesn't constitute the arson, but could you explain the difference so everybody understands that?
I guess, Your Honor, sorry, used to be in a court.
go ahead.
Representative Howell, Chair Cornish, there's a statute out, it's 609.564, it has excluded fires. So what that does is where you have a valid permit, those fires are excluded. So as long as you follow the permit process and follow all the rules of the permit and whatever conditions that are placed on that permit, you're in fine shape. I guess the only possible potential would be if you were grossly negligent, if you had other exposures and just kind of lit the thing and let it go and it wound up, taking out a city block. Then maybe there's some negligence or some other, situation. But as long as you follow the permit process, there is a statute in place that does exclude those fires. So we're not worried about that, reaching, or this bill reaching into some of those situations.
I think the DNR takes care of statute 8816, I think, is their burning permit statute. And then if it gets out of hand and wrecks a lot of places, they usually hit you with a civil penalty and not arson. So anybody have any more questions? Okay, Representative Johnson, closing comments.
Closing comments would basically be that this just fills a hole that this organization is looking at in the different statutes dealing with arson and dealing with fires to help protect our emergency personnel and our firefighters. I would ask that you support this bill.
Thank you. And then anybody from the public wish to testify? Seeing none, we'll move Representative Johnson's bill, House File 801, to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Moving right along here, now we have Jackie Mines, the Director of the Emergency Communications Network, for a call back for a discussion. And Ms. Mines, or Director Mines, could you give your name and title for the record and maybe just give an overview of what you do before we ask you any questions? I know there were some members that had questions about the organization. And so, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name for the record is Jackie Mines. Director of Emergency Communication Networks Division, a division of the Department of Public Safety. And I thank you for your interest in our program today. ECN funds and supports interoperable public safety grade mission critical communication solutions used by citizens of Minnesota and emergency responders to communicate during an emergency. So what that means is we support the 911 program, the next generation 911 program, the statewide radio system called ARMOR, the statewide interoperability program so that there's interoperability between these communication methodologies, the wireless broadband for public safety program, and we support the statewide emergency communications board, formerly known as the radio board, which now encompasses and looks at all of these emergency communications since there's a lot of synergy between these technologies. We are funded through a collection of the 911 fee. We collect that fee on wireline phones, wireless phones, VoIP phones, and prepaid wireless. Services provided are the statewide 911 backbone that allows you to dial 911 from any device and hit the 911 network. We support the dispatch centers and the 911 dispatch centers that answer the call. We achieve 95% mobile radio coverage across all rural and metro counties, permitting emergency responders to communicate with every dispatch center and also with one another seamlessly. And we provide grant dollars to local units of government to help them purchase different equipment that's needed to interface with these backbone systems. We also support training, and as I said before, we support the emergency communications governance structure as well as all of the committees under that structure that establish training standards, interoperable standards, and how the use of the system is permitted. With that, I'll entertain questions and go into detail on the budget request.
Commissioner, did you come to testify or just ask, answer questions?
Mr. Chair, Mark Janaski, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. Yes, I'm here in support of Ms. Mines, and to reiterate that she used the term support the number of times. The SECB, or the Statewide Emergency Communications Board, really is the governance body that directs ECN to do the things that she just talked about. And the Commissioner of Public Safety is designated as a chair of that board, and I serve in that role as her proxy.
Okay. I would like to give you a list of questions here that we've been wondering about, if you would, Ms. Mines or Commissioner Danisky. First one is, what's the current tax rate imposed, and what do you do to intend to increase it? I mean, why and...
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current 911 fee is at 78 cents. It's been at 78 cents for the last few years. Before that, it was at 80 cents. And we are proposing to raise that fee to 95 cents, which is permitted under this current statute to support these initiatives.
Which initiatives, again, is that, just quickly?
So I'll just go into detail on the different items. The budget request is based upon the division carrying out the strategic direction that the Statewide Emergency Communications Board has identified for the next 5 years. The board met this fall to create the strategic direction, and the items before us are the ones that the board would like us to proceed to implement. And the first of those is support text to 911 application. So we're asking approximately $1.5 million each year to help develop the services that will allow this to take place, and the public education program that we'll need to embark on to make sure residents of Minnesota know how to engage text to 911 when it's appropriate. This is especially useful for our members of the deaf and hard of hearing community. They have are not using TTY machines or TTD machines anymore. And this text to 911 option is also highly supported by the FCC. People in domestic violence and home invasion situations would also benefit from this. The goal is not to replace voice, but to have an option for those people that need it when they need it. The second initiative is to support geographical information systems for next generation 911. So one of the issues today is finding exact location of callers when they're dialing from a wireless or VoIP. The network works so fast that you can actually hear the call ring at the dispatcher at the same time the caller's actually hearing the ringback tone. So one of the challenges is making sure that wireless carriers provide exact location at time of call setup. To do that, we need to make sure that we have collected and validated all of the county's geographical information system information, and we will use that at the point wireless carriers are ready to provide it to validate which PSAP or 911 dispatch center to send the call to, and also to make sure we have your exact location when you call. The third initiative is associated with ARMR. So the Statewide Radio Board decided that it would be best at this point in time to continue to keep the ARMR system upgraded on a regular basis. The advantages to doing that are that typically the types of software upgrades that are provided have to do with security breaches on that happen over time with the different types of communications hardware in the system. So to ensure that we have the system kept up to date, because there is a significant investment in the system, as well as making sure that counties have an understanding of how to budget each year, as well as our office budgeting each year, we're supporting the upgrade process. The 7.19 upgrade is something that will occur 5 years from now, but we need to raise money over the course of the next 4 years and upgrade about some of the users on the system who've been on the system for a number of years. So there's some large pieces of that infrastructure that are end of life cycle, meaning they've been in use for about 20 years, which is a typical life cycle for something like that. And this is a 50% matching grant for specific pieces of that hardware that would offset some of the local costs associated with that. Primarily that affects the metro area, St. Cloud and Rochester, who were the first users of the ARMR system. The last increase we're looking for is a general increase in operating budget. The first of that reason for that is we need to increase the state's portion of some of that hardware for the 7.19 upgrade, and then the other 2.9 each year would be for the increase that it costs us to run the next generation 911 network. And I'm open to entertain questions. Thank you.
This is a big whack in one time. I was wondering, there was some skepticism when we thought about getting into this new system and about this very thing, increases in costs. When will it stop, you think? I mean, we get to the max, and then what do we do? Are we going to continually upgrade these things? Or it seems this is a pretty new system. It seems to be wearing out fast.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that it does appear that these are some very large infrastructure investments. And again, we have some of the initial users on the system have been on since, you know, about in 4 years, 5 years, it will be about 15 to 20 years, depending on when they came on board with the system. I think that the big question in front of the board was, do we take the risk of not upgrading, and then since we know we will need this system in the foreseeable future, we're looking at least the next 10 years, would we stop upgrading it? There's a risk involved in that as well, and that is keeping the system, excuse me, keeping the system secure, as well as if we find out in a few years that we would need to upgrade it for some reason, a feature that's necessary or whatever it is, that upgrade cost might be quite large. So what other states who have done that have looked at is a $30 to $40 million hit at one time. That's very difficult to finance, both for the locals and for the state. So we'd prefer to keep the system upgraded with a consistent cost, much like you use for car insurance or health insurance, over the course of the next 5 years. And over that period of time, the board will continue to analyze whether or not keeping the system upgraded is necessary or not.
Okay, we'll go to the third question, and Representative Lucero and others might have questions. Do you have a detailed breakdown of how you spend the local grants and subsidies? Where are the money going as far as how much to metro versus rural?
I don't have an exact breakout, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. However, what we, a couple of years ago, we verified how much was used, how much grant money we'd sent out to locals to build the armor system. And generally speaking, over both entities, both the Metro and Greater Minnesota, it was about 50% of their local cost. The Metro obviously has a much greater investment in that, so it's a little bit less than the Metro, but we have always tried to be give out grant money commensurate with the type of cost that each of those entities is incurring.
Commissioner Danesky.
Mr. Chair, if I may, going back, I want to remind the committee again that all this is vetted through the Statewide Emergency Communications Board, and they have a finance committee that meets, and the board is very, very active. So these discussions about grant dollars and how the grant formulas are going to be made on an annual basis go through that governance body and are, quite frankly, debated quite frequently.
Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my questions are for either testifier, and I have several. The first one is, in regarding to the location service on the mobile devices themselves, how is that triggered? The ability to locate or pinpoint somebody.
So that begins with the wireless carriers. So right now, the wireless carrier triangulates your call at call setup, and they use three towers approximately to locate your location. It does take a little while to find that location at this point in time. The FCC's requirements are to build a set of milestones over the next 6 years to pinpoint more accurately, more quickly, each caller's location. That then is pushed into a location database at the time of call setup and delivered at the 911 dispatch center.
Okay, thank you, Madam, or thank you, Mr. Chair. And just maybe to be more specific on my question, when I dial 911 on my mobile phone now, it enters into what's called emergency mode. Mm-hmm. And is that what triggers? In other words, do I control when I dial 911? Is it the user, the holder of the device, who controls the ability for the system to pinpoint them and then to be able to turn that off? I guess to be more specific on my question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. You can control that ability yourself, like you can control turning off your ability to dial 911. However, I want to make clear that we're not tracking your device from 911 perspective. We are at call setup, that triangulation or that location of your device is being initiated, and it's being initiated by you dialing the digits 911.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, when I'm looking at the proposal here, I'm seeing the words implement text to 911, upgrade hardware. I'm sorry, you're not seeing this. This is a summary of what you're proposing. But it's implement, it's upgrade the hardware components, it is create the 911 interface. The word create is equal to deploy. I'm in the technology field, and whenever we're implementing new infrastructure, new systems, there's naturally this need for more staff. But after it's deployed, then it goes back down again because it's a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. So in the request here, the terms implement, upgrade, and deploy these new systems, but then I'm seeing the request for two more FTEs. Now, I understand you will need those to do these things initially, but then in general, we implement new systems because they're more efficient, so then they will reduce the number of hours required from employees. So my concern here is after we engage in those initial deployment activities, the two FTEs that are being requested are going to continue on in perpetuity. Is my understanding correct?
Dr. Mines.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. That is the request at this point. We have just traditionally, as I said before, we've lowered the fee, we've raised the fee. You know, we do that based on the needs of the business at that time. We are going through quite a change in the technology that people are using, and one of our concerns is being able to keep up with that technology and making sure that we have the resources and the knowledge available on staff to be able to direct the correct purchase of technology and support of that technology. In the legacy 911 world, when all we dealt with was, you know, you dial 911 from a stationary device, that stationary device doesn't change unless you move, you know, from one building or to another, or you change home addresses. That technology was pretty straightforward. Now it becomes much more difficult, and we have to have the technology expertise on staff to be able to troubleshoot, and we're utilizing multiple vendors as opposed to just one vendor. Like in the old days, it was just the telephone company. The telephone company had staff that really understood how 911 worked. Now we tend to work with multiple providers, and we need to help identify where is the problem, how do we fix it, and push those vendors to move forward in the correct direction. So it takes a little more expertise. There might be a point in the future where we don't need as much, where this technology settles down and we can operate with less staff again. But we have a small staff to perform the projects we're doing today. And one of the things we want to make sure is that we don't stretch them too thin and, you know, make decisions that we're not able to without proper vetting and understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one, not a question, but just a comment. And I'm very familiar with that. So being a technologist myself, we never reach the end point. It's a continual learning process. It is a requirement to keep our skills up to date with the new software and technologies that are constantly emerging. But when we're learning the new stuff, we're changing our processes. So granted, the old 911 system was a process that current FTEs in your department were familiar with, but as the capabilities have changed, the processes are going to change. So I would think that those same people currently on staff, just like I have to do, will learn the new processes. But learning new information and new ways of doing things with new technology shouldn't necessarily require more staff. It's retraining existing staff. I guess that's the concern I'm getting at with the request for two additional FTEs.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is regarding the cost. You had mentioned the granting of funds, and so sort of I have two questions. I'm assuming that the granting of funds is primarily for hardware, not for software and for added staff costs. And with that being the case, I'm assuming that local jurisdictions that have their own systems are going to incur a larger burden of the cost as the switchover takes place. Would that be a correct assumption?
Director Mines.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a labor component that each organization will have to incur, and the other 50% of the pieces of hardware. However, our partner agency at MnDOT supports a lot of this initiative, and they have offered to help support the local regions so that they would not necessarily have to hire outside labor, that they could help either train their existing staff or show some support in that area. And this is done quite often. So I'm not going to deny that there will be a cost at the local level. Typically, our match is not at 50%. We did that on purpose because to budget properly for a grant, we need to know ahead of time to go to the legislature what our costs will be. Labor costs tends to shift because someone in the metro might hire someone at a higher rate than someone in the rural area. So in that effort to be more than fair, we identified a 50% match as opposed to our typical 40% match on average for each grant, so that there was some help in that in the labor costs to offset that, but we don't have access to that type of information.
Okay, and just a follow-up to that, regarding the actual cost, is the system that you're going to be implementing, is it a robust system, is it a minimal system? And if it's a minimal system, what are the contingencies and other factors that you've taken into consideration in the event that you go 80% down the road and you're not getting the performance that you need, and you need to shift or you need to add cost or add resources to fully implement it?
Director Mines.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify, are you referring to the radio system, the hardware upgrade, or are you referring to the 911 or to both?
Representative
Dean. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd really be referring to both, and then, of course, once the hardware system's in place, there's going to be the cost of the software associated with it that, you know, last time I checked, that the implementation of most software systems have generally don't go as smoothly and as on budget as they're often planned.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much for being here and answering questions for us. It makes it a little clearer. So,
thank you very much for your time.
You bet. And unless many members have any questions, meeting is adjourned.